Fine.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good.
That's good. Snuck away to the movies a couple of times this weekend, so that was good.
A couple of times?
Yeah, a couple. Can you believe it?
And now that was with or without Talia?
That's without the family.
By yourself?
By myself, yes.
Jesus, you're going to pay for that.
maybe. Well, they were off doing their own stuff, so... but I saw Winter Soldier again.
Yeah, I've heard it's amazing.
It's really fantastic. I mean, it really... Even the second time, even though I knew stuff was coming, I just kind of... I like to sometimes go... Whoa, that is my cell phone going off with the Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I got to turn off the sound.
You have to take that.
yeah, no, I mean, it's pretty amazing as far as like how they keep the tension going and all that stuff.
I've been watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
It doesn't compare.
Well, I know, but now I wasn't going to bother with Winter Soldier because I didn't see the first Captain America.
Oh.
But now they're like mentioning a lot of stuff about that's clearly was in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
And sucking me into it. And also the reviews have been fantastic, you know, to the extent that people aren't saying that it's a good Avengers movie, they're saying it's a good movie.
Yeah. I think you should maybe take the time to see the first one. You know, just rent it. I mean, it's a good rental. I mean, I thought it was a solid movie on its own, you know, kind of to tie in, you know, with everything else, all the other, you know, Marvel stuff. But you know, it'll give you some good background info, and
right.
Then you can go into the Winter Soldier. But I would recommend it. It's a good, you know, if you got time to sneak away from the family, or you know, one of your kids doesn't have a problem, or you don't have a problem with them seeing a lot of gunplay,
right?
Because there is a lot of that.
Romy already saw Winter Soldier.
Oh, really?
So she said I think she saw it with her grandfather.
Oh,
and she said, "Yeah, it was great. You should totally see it, Daddy." I'm like, "Okay." The jury is in.
That's awesome. Cool. Well, but we're not here to talk about the Winter Soldier. What are we here to talk about?
We're here to talk about the Eternal Soldier.
Yeah, exactly. But first of all, this is Part-Time Fanboy, and my name is Christian Horn, and I'm here with our Doctor Who expert, Barry Negrin.
Hello.
Who has been with us since what? Like, what was it? The Day of the Doctor, right?
Yes.
That was sort of our first podcast together.
The
it seems so long ago.
Special. I know, centuries perhaps.
Centuries. But so we're here to talk about the second chapter in The Key to Time, correct?
Yes.
Yes, and this one is called The Pirate Planet.
The Pirate
Planet. So let's go into a little bit of your history with it. How long has it been since you first saw this one?
This episode I probably first saw in the... I want to say late 80s, early 90s, which is still quite a bit later than it aired.
Oh,
This aired in 1978 originally.
78, yeah.
But this is
post-Star Wars.
But it's just post-Star Wars.
Yeah.
You know, and I suspect I know where you're going with that. You know, the funny thing is that when I saw it in the late 80s, early 90s, that didn't dawn on me.
Uh-huh.
But because, you know, at that point, Star Wars had like receded in my memory. That was already, you know, late 70s, early 80s. It really didn't dawn on me that this is basically Douglas Adams taking a piss all over Star Wars.
Yeah, to a certain extent. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
You know, for those of our listeners, or maybe listener who hasn't seen The Pirate Planet, you know, so why don't you set up the story about, I mean, so where we have the, you know, to recap from last time, the Doctor and his new companion Romana are pouncing around the universe looking for pieces of the key to time.
Yes.
Which is an errand set by them, by the White Guardian, to assemble this very mighty piece of, you know, time engineering machinery that's going to be able to allow the White Guardian to sort of correct the balances in the universe. And they found the first piece in the previous episode, and now they're looking for the second piece.
Yes.
So why don't you tee up where, you know, where we are as far as the pirate planet goes?
Well, from what I remember, you know, and I did quickly watch some of the beginnings and ends, like on Netflix, like just yesterday and today, just so I could reacquaint myself with it. But so they're trying to find this thing that there's six parts of the key to time.
Yes.
And again, you said the White Guard, this like godly being called the White Guardian, is trying to get them to collect these pieces to keep them away from the Black Guardian.
Two things. Keep them away from the Black Guardian, and so that the White Guardian can sort of restore the balance to the universe.
Yeah, yeah. So at this point, Doctor Who and Romana have kind of recovered from their, you know, adventures on Rybos, you know, where they thwarted an intergalactic sort of land scam.
Yes.
Yeah, real estate deal, you know, a la Superman the movie. No, not quite that, but something like that. And where we begin is they're both on the TARDIS, and do they get a signal, or they're trying to figure out where the next segment is, and they sort of mistakenly land, right? Is that correct?
Well, they have this tracer that the White Guardian gave the Doctor.
Yes.
To find, to detect these pieces. And Romana had basically cut a hole in the TARDIS console.
Yeah.
To where the tracer would fit in so that the tracer can key in on the right coordinates.
Yeah.
So they have some trouble trying to land the first time because they try to materialize at the same exact time and space as this other ship that they don't know is really a ship.
Yeah.
When they first land.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting, just even the beginning of that episode, you know, before they even land, Romana's already getting a lot much less haughty, and she's much more of an eager assistant at this point.
Yeah. But, yeah. I noticed that right away, too. I noticed, well, first of all, they changed her outfit.
Yes.
I don't know if from the beginning she was wearing the pink, like, grease sort of a 50s outfit,
yeah,
you know.
Pinky Tuscadero, yes.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
She was not, no.
She was not wearing the sort of glamorous, you know, I don't know what you would call that, like swan princess queen outfit that my wife loved so much on the first segment of The Key to Time.
Look, the show has something for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she had definitely lost a little bit of that wise ass, you know, sort of snarky, like, I know more than you attitude that she had in the last series. So you can already see that they're sort of like the writers are toning her down a little bit.
Well, also that they're warming up to each other, that, you know, the Doctor didn't want her there in the first place. He wanted to work by himself.
For sure.
And she thought that, you know, he barely scraped out of the academy. But now she realizes, wow, this guy's really smart. He's got a street smarts that she hopes to have someday. But, you know, at the young age of 110, she certainly has no chance of having.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing I missed a little bit of, because I sort of like, I mean, it's not the moonlighting, like snarkiness, like sexual tension going back and forth. But I did like the Doctor dealing with somebody from his own planet for extended periods of time, like his own race, and having them sort of like give him a hard time, you know? I mean, I suppose we see that with, what's her face? You know, his wife, you know who I'm talking about. Alex Kingston, River Song.
There you go.
Okay, so,
AKA,
you know,
Melody
a little
Pond.
Bit like River Song from the current episodes. But at this point, she's like, Romana's the only companion, you know what I'm saying? And I kind of like that he has that little bit of insecurity, because as little as I've seen of the Tom Baker ones, he's always kind of got the up and up on his companion.
Oh, yeah.
And that last segment of The Key to Time, the Ribos operation, or Ribos, whatever, we never figured that out, you know, she was kind of giving him a hard time, and he was getting his feathers ruffled, which you don't see a lot of that in this particular part of The Key to Time. You know?
They were a much smoother team. But by the way, you're forgetting one major companion. Yeah, how can you forget K-9? K-9 is...
Oh, that's right.
You know, he's not nothing. I mean, he's crucial to the advancement of the plot most of the time once he lumbers around into the, you know, camera view.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the sort of thing that it's very interesting because the one thing that I wanted to mention, you know, and for anybody watching this, it takes me like a good like episode and a half to sort of like get with the technology wasn't as great back then as it is today. Like, there's a real bit of culture shock when I start watching these, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, it's shot on videotape, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you can see that the outdoor shots are on film, but the indoor shots are on video.
Yeah.
I think, you're more of the media savvy guy than I am. I thought it was that they could basically save money because tape is cheaper than film.
Oh, yeah. Much cheaper. Yeah, yeah.
Let me ask you this. Why wouldn't they shoot tape outside? It just looks like crap.
I think that at that time there might have been limitations, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
As far as like maybe the cameras that they could take, or who knows like what setup they could use, or maybe they just didn't have the equipment, you know what I mean?
Right.
Who knows? Who knows what was available to them? But yeah, that's always been the shocking thing about especially like 70s, early 80s BBC production has been like when they go outside, it's a bit of a jarring effect. You're like, hey, what just happened?
Right.
But either way, I find the whole thing charming from the beginning, but I do have to say that there is a little bit of like, okay, I have to be patient now. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I mean, as we've discussed, the older episodes are at a much, you know, calmer pace, you know, and in fact, there's no the ambient music that's always constantly drowning out the actors. You know, you can hear them speaking quite clearly.
Yeah.
You can hear the hum of the TARDIS in the background at all times. You know, it's nice. I mean, it takes some getting used to if you started off with New Who. And in fact, actually, even for somebody like me who started off with Classic Who, it's like I really have to like sort of shift back down gear, you know, into a lower gear.
Yeah.
That I can think about how slow the pacing of the show is.
Yeah. So, I mean, the beginning of this episode, like you said, sees us like they end up on a planet or what they think is a planet, you know, called Calyutrax, correct?
Calyufrax, yes.
Calyufrax, sorry.
They try to land there, but they can't. And then when they arrive, they do land. There's mineral wealth strewn all over the street like crazy.
Yeah, they're basically finding like diamonds and rubies and like basic things that are rare in other corners of the universe and very valuable.
Right. And what develops is that there's this sort of planet-shaped hollow ship that jumps from planet to planet, materializes around it, yeah, mines the hell out of it, pulverizes it, uses up all the resources, and then just sort of leaves this husk, or leaves nothing, because as we discover later on, the main engineer behind this takes the remnants from the planets and crumbles them up into these tiny little balls.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah, we're getting a little bit of ahead of ourselves, but that's basically what you've got is sort of like a Galactus scenario, sort of like from the Fantastic Four comics,
right.
Is that there's this planet that what they end up finding out later on in the episodes that is going from planet to planet and just sucking out all the life essence, you know, whether the planet is inhabited or not, and using it for its own purposes.
Right.
And in the meantime, the people who actually live on this planet... They have no idea that this is what's happening. All they know is that, like, a certain period of time goes by and the quote-unquote...
The stars change. Oh, the lights change. Yeah.
Yeah, the lights start changing in the sky and there's a captain that they've never met, a guy who calls himself the captain who announces, what does he announce? Like the wealth of...
The new age of prosperity.
That's what it is. The new age of prosperity has begun. And then, you know, they start finding, you know, more precious jewels or gems and stuff on the street. Right. And basically it's this society that's been spoiled. But the thing that I never really, or I don't remember, is what did the people on the pirate planet who didn't know that it was a pirate planet call it? Do you know?
Xanak. They called it Xanak.
Oh, Xanak. So they did call it Xanak.
Yes, because that was their planet. I mean, originally it was a planet. And they, the captain and the other royal involved, yeah, had hollowed out their own planet to mine it for all that it was worth, turned it into this, you know, hyper-jumping ship, this planet-eating ship, and then bounced around. So the people of Xanak had no idea.
That's right, that's right. They were just kind of like...
Along for the ride.
Yeah, along for the ride and kind of stupefied as to how things worked and, you know, didn't really know anything. The only thing that they knew is that, or some of them knew, is that they didn't necessarily have their free, quote-unquote, freedom, right?
Right.
Yeah, and you eventually run into a couple of, you know, inhabitants of the planet, and they, you know, what you see is sort of a system of fear in place. That every once in a while, right after the lights in the sky go crazy, and everything, you know, the stars in the sky move position, that certain people become sick. Correct?
Yes, they develop this sort of deathly pallor. They get this, they sort of get a fever of the brain, and then they go join this group of weirdos, robe-wearing weirdos.
Hare Krishnas.
Called the Mentiads, yes.
Yeah.
And they live in, like, the catacombs, they live in the forest, they live, you know, off the beaten path.
Yeah, very off the beat. Well, that's the thing, is that the residents of Xanak are terrified of these Mentiads, correct?
Because the captain and his guard and the government basically keep the propaganda going that the Mentiads are treasonous, that they're against the government, that they will, you know, kill you on sight, and that they're dangerous and they're not to be trusted.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And in down the line, what you begin to discover is that there's a lot more to these Mentiats and the captain's sort of machinations. The captain, who is the captain of the pirate planet, he basically, yes, pilots it, and he's played by a very bombastic, loud actor. I gotta say, after
gorgeously.
A while, what's that?
Gorgeously.
Yeah, I guess gorgeously could be the term. I mean, I enjoyed it, but there were definitely times where I was like, could somebody please tell that guy to speak in his indoor voice? Because every sentence he says, he was like, by the Lord of the snakes of the universe, or whatever it is he says. Like,
right.
He's just always talking like a Jack Kirby Marvel comic, like in giant... Like, it seems like everyone typed his dialogue in, like, giant caps.
Caps, right.
You know what I'm saying?
No, you know, he did actually, though, at one point, he did speak like a normal person when he was showing off his trophy case to the doctor.
Oh.
You know, he did, when he was basically, when he was being serious, when he wasn't being a big blowhard, he was, you know, when it turns out that he's this brilliant, you know, gravitic engineer, too. You know, he can talk like a normal person. He also recognizes the doctor is almost as smart as he is. So,
yeah, yeah.
You know, he can speak to him as a peer instead of as like an ant that he's about to crush.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's backtrack a little bit, because the story essentially is, you know, Doctor Who and Romana, they get sidetracked in the TARDIS because they're trying to find this planet, and they end up landing on the pirate planet.
Right.
And what you... through their discoveries, they meet these people that are terrified of the Mentiads.
Yes.
And Mentiads, sorry.
Yes.
And they eventually meet the head of the planet, which we've talked about, the captain. And
right.
So what ends up happening is...
And we meet the captain, and he's basically... Clearly, he was injured in some kind of accident.
Yes.
And he's half, you know, cyborg. You know, he's a human, clearly, but he has like a big robot arm. He's got a robot eye.
Yeah.
You know, he's had some work done.
definitely.
You know.
He's been to the $6 million man school of cosmetics.
Of redesign, yes.
Yeah, exactly. I have to say that I really enjoyed his design. Like, I really thought it was kind of fun, and it made me, when I was watching the episode, go like, oh, I think they poured a little bit of money into this. You know, I mean, it's nowhere near as good as, like...
Oh, I don't think so.
What's that?
I don't think they poured any money into it at all.
You don't think so?
I think he looked good, but, you know, I think his arm did not look really too mechanized. I think it was basically a sleeve that he was wearing.
Yeah, of course. But don't you think that for that show, I mean, you know more. You've seen many, many more episodes than I have. But don't you think that for that show, that costuming was pretty decent? Like, okay. I really thought, like, you know, the helmet and the arm. Like, I mean, I guess I haven't seen enough of, like, old Doctor Who. Are there a lot of, like, besides, like, say, sort of the Cybermen? I mean, to me, it looked like there was a lot of detail in that arm. I mean,
obviously,
it looks fake, but, right?
That's the thing, is that it still looks like chintzy crap, but there was
well,
a
to
lot
us.
Of, yes. No, I know, but there was definitely, the show is moving, sort of evolving a little bit more in its budget, I think, at this point. It was like season 16 at this point or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, no, it definitely, this was a well-tailored episode. You also have to remember who the author was. Douglas Adams wrote this.
Yeah. Now, was he a big name in sci-fi at the time?
I don't think so.
You don't think so? So this is before he... You know, before all his books became, you know, world famous. And
yeah, I think Hitchhiker's was like 81 or so, 82.
Oh, okay.
So this was 78.
Uh-huh.
You know, in fact, he actually wrote this episode, this series of episodes. He filled in for the writer who was supposed to write it, but that guy either had a conflict or he backed out for some reason. Anyway, the show was in a lurch because they didn't have anybody to write this show and the series. And he's like, I'll do it. And, you know, it was, you know, unbeknownst to anybody at the time, it was classic Douglas Adams, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what's really interesting to me is reading up about it on Wikipedia. It seems like the original story that Adams wrote was like heavily edited by the script editor. Like, it seems like the story was a bit different and dealt something like with the actual Time Lord doing something.
Really?
And, yeah, it had to be, like, pared down. So this may not be, like, you know, the full Douglas Adams, like, what he envisioned for the episode.
I'm going to have to look into that because I did not know that.
Yeah, apparently on the DVD commentary, there's a little bit more, you know, story behind that. But, right. You know, I watched it on Netflix, so I don't know. But who knows what Adams came up with? I mean, probably some crazy stuff.
Well, the very fact that he came up with this, you know, sort of planet-eating device, it, like, that sort of almost is a clairvoyant predicate to his, you know, Vogons destroying Earth to make way for a hyperspatial byway.
Uh-huh.
Although, you know, planet-destroying devices have been around since at least the 60s, when, you know, the Star Trek Doomsday Machine.
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah, but I really do like the idea of, you know, however much it reminded me of, like, again, the comic book character Galactus, but
right.
The idea of, like, a planet, like a whole freaking planet that just travels through whatever, warp space or interdimensional whatever.
Right.
You know, there was a lot more scientific gobbledygook in this episode, too, but in this series than you know, the past, but, you know, the idea of a planet just sort of like warping and then surrounding or filling the space of another planet. I thought that was pretty ingenious.
It was,
you know,
it was. And yet there are a tremendous number of parallels to Star Wars, which, you know, had come out only a year before. I mean, so you have this pirate planet is very similar to the Death Star. I mean, it doesn't shoot the planet, but it destroys it.
Yeah.
You know, the captain is clearly a spoof of Darth Vader.
Absolutely.
You know, the it turns out as we get further into the episode, he has this sort of nurse that takes care of him. It turns out that she's really pulling the strings, that she's really this aged queen, Xancia, who was a monster. She's the one who started the whole process.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then, you know, you've got this whole corps of guards, the captain's guards, who are like the stormtroopers who can't seem to hit anything.
Well, they've got the, first of all, no offense, they look like a bunch of S&M guys carrying dildos around with those ridiculous guns. I was like, wow, somebody, the costume designer was having a lot of fun here with the prop guy, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, I was like, wow, this could easily, very easily, like, you know those porn parody videos that they keep making about Superman and stuff like that? Like, I could very easily see, like, a porn, like, I was just like, wow, maybe that's just my filthy mind, but I was just like, I can't believe how S&M these guys look, you know?
Right.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, again, sort of trying to adapt to the sort of technology, you saying that they can't hit anything, but it's like, how can you hit anything if you can't see where your shots are going?
Yes, because there's like a little red dot that shows up.
Yeah,
somewhere.
It's like, it's not even like a stream of light, or you don't see like explosions, you just see this like really poorly matted, you know, stream of light on top of, you know, the film or whatever.
But the funny thing is that towards the end of the episode, Romana, of all people, at one point grabs one of these crappy little penis laser rifles, shoots the guard on the first shot, and he just falls down dead or stunned. Like, she's apparently a crack shot.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the whole point of this, you know, series is basically that, again, it's called the Pirate Planet because it's basically, you know, stealing resources from other planets and decimating them. And in the meantime, it's keeping its populace happy by giving them everything they need so they won't suspect. And
right.
So the Doctor and Romana, you know, through the course of their investigations and their dealings with the Mentiads, you know, come
who
to discover...
out, you know, AKA the Jedi.
Maybe.
I think. Come on, the Jedi have all these mental powers. You know, they can convince you to fall asleep. They can levitate stuff. So can the Mentiads.
Yeah, I guess
they
so.
They wear robes.
Yeah, but what I liked about the Mentiads is A, that people kept referring to them as sort of like space zombies or whatever.
Right, but they're not, though. I mean, they're telepathic. And when the life force of the planet that they happen to be sitting on right now dies and is sucked out, these people can feel it the same way Obi-Wan Kenobi felt it when Alderaan was destroyed by the Death Star.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point that you're pointing out there. I mean, that's how the Mentiads develop, because of the trauma of either a world dying or the people on the world dying. There's the inhabitants of Zanak. Do they just say one, or do they say, because to me it just seems like it's a town, but, you know, obviously they can't do the scope of a planet on this budget.
No.
But it seems like, is it just one person at a time that develops these powers, or was that ever made clear? Because
it wasn't, but it only looked like there was about, you know, maybe a dozen and a half Mentiads. So.
Yeah, so the Mentiads develop psychic powers, or a person becomes a Mentiad because of the inherent trauma caused by
the
death of a world.
It's the latter. I mean, we saw that one guy, Prelix, who was like a regular guy up until the last jump. And when they finished destroying Calyphrax, he really, you know, got his Mentiad on.
Yeah. I mean, and so, in the course of events, the Doctor and Romana, they basically discover that the Mentiads are not, you know, everything that the inhabitants of the world think they are, which, you know, I think specifically they do call them space zombies because they're terrified of them,
right.
But that they are actually a force that can be used against the captain of the ship for good, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, and that I thought was like a really nice little twist. It's funny because, again, this series, like in the very beginning, I was a little bit like, wow. it wasn't just the parallels to Star Wars like that you're pointing out, because I honestly didn't think that deep into it, but I felt that there was a difference in stuff that I'd seen before, like the Pertwee episodes and, you know, the older stuff, where I felt that the sets were a lot more complex. I felt that the sci-fi gobbledygook was a little bit more prevalent. I felt that, you know, again, you know, there was a little bit more action in these episodes.
Only was it more prevalent gobbledygook, but it almost was more consistent and made sense.
Yeah, you know? yeah, 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 and I just felt that a lot of these things combined together was someone at the BBC, you know, which is basically what everyone did after Star Wars. They anyone who was like involved in a sci-fi production or trying to get something. What's that?
They stepped up their game.
Yeah, well, they just went, oh crap, you know.
Right. It's this like, is what can. This is what is possible.
Yeah, and not even this is what is possible. This is what we have to compete against.
Right.
You know?
That's true.
So obviously, Doctor Who, you know, the people behind that, seeing that, just went like, oh fuck. You know, like we're gonna have to do something, you know. So that's what stuck out to me from the very beginning. I mean, once it landed on the planet and once you saw like the captain's bridge, you know, quote unquote, and you know, a lot of the other stuff, I was like, okay, I don't know if it's either they poured a little more money or they just utilized the money that they had better, but somebody said like, we got to step up our game a little bit.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, and from there, it just seems like even the scope of this was kind of larger as far as the plot was concerned, right? Like the twists and the turns that it took, don't you think?
Yeah, no, there was definitely, it wasn't nearly, well, you know, yes. I mean, well, if you go back to some of the older ones, like there was a second Doctor one, Patrick Troughton, The Tomb of the Cybermen. You know, that one was pretty straightforward and linear, where you've got these people who are excavating the Tomb of the Cybermen, and the Doctor says, don't do it. And they say, we're going to do it anyway. And then you do it, and, you know, calamity ensues.
Yeah.
You know? And then the Doctor spends his time putting the Cybermen back. Here, this one, you already had, said, like, even as late, even as early as the Pertwee episodes, you know, there were some twists and turns. There was a great episode that's on Netflix now called The Green Death. And it's a very environmental, eco-friendly episode where you've got this company that's running something and it's creating these gigantic, you know, grub worms that are like 6 feet long. And because of the toxic waste that they're pouring into this mine, and, you know, there's like a whole bunch of things going on. And so like there are layers episode. So this is not like the first time you've seen it. Also, in some of the earlier Tom Baker episodes, like The Invasion of Time, which was right before The Key to Time, the end of season 15, he's on Gallifrey, and he's sort of helping an invasion, except that it's really a trap. It's like the Tom Baker episodes, I find, are like some of the more complex ones.
So when does Tom Baker start Doctor Who? Like, what year?
1974.
Oh, okay. So he's been in the game for a while now, at least 4 years.
Yes.
Oh, okay. So he's well established.
Yes.
On the show at this point. Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know more than I do, of course. So for me, not having been exposed to a lot of episodes, it seemed to me like they were just like, really like, okay, Star Wars, there's before Star Wars and there's after Star Wars, and here we go. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And but, you know, maybe not as far as the plot is concerned, but for me it just seemed like the sets and stuff were a little more complex. I don't know.
Well, I've always found that the anytime that they went to Gallifrey, the outfits were nice. I mean, they always had good costuming for the Time Lords themselves.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, they never let, I mean, these people were supposedly the pinnacle of evolution in the universe, right? So they're not going to, you know, go around and schmott us.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that, like, the whole thing just plays out really well as far as, you know, I'm comparing it to other episodes that I've seen.
Like, and, like such as?
Well, I've seen, like, the Ark in Space.
Oh, that was terrible. I mean, it was a good story, but that one looked so terrible.
That was
one of the shittier looking episodes in the Tom Baker years. I think that was like his second or third episode.
Yeah, and I've seen like the first Pertwee series, which was with the mannequins.
Oh, those were dreadful. I mean, but look, you're lucky that they were in color. They just went to color at that point. I'm serious.
Oh, was Pertwee the first color?
Yes.
Oh, I did not know that.
In 1970.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So before him was the dome-haired doctor, right?
Yes, Mo.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense then. But, I mean, at least to me, you know, with my experience with what I've seen, this was definitely, to me, sort of one of the better looking ones that I've seen.
Yeah.
And I felt that the effects budget seemed, obviously, there's a gag in this series where they're traveling down hallways and it just like zips them up and down. And obviously it's just like some shitty green screen and really bad. But for that show and at that time and the production values for that time, it seemed to me that it was like really, really, that they were going the extra mile, you know?
Well, at least a kilometer, because, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we are talking the metric system. Right. Like I said, it seemed to me like this kind of stepped up the game from the Rybos operation.
Oh, even from the Rybos. Well, you also have to remember the Rybos operation was set in, like, a medieval setting. So,
yeah.
You know, there wasn't much to look at. You had catacombs, you had a lot of old stuff, you had people in fur, because it was, you know, year 50 of the 75-year ice time.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There wasn't a lot to look at. The inhabitants were kind of slow-witted and, you know, backward, and they only had, like, all of these futuristic infiltrators trying to get in on the action. Whereas here, you've got an advanced race, very advanced, you know, an impressive engineer in the captain. You've got the power behind the throne, you know, the Queen Xancia / Emperor Palpatine pulling his strings, you know, with, you know, stopping, you know, her death in behind these time dams. I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, chrono engineering. That's crazy advanced, right?
So, yeah. Yeah. Well, and that ends up being what the payoff is. It's sort of by the end of the episode, right? Is the big plot is that the captain is not really in charge. You find out at the end, which, you know, spoilers, anyone who hasn't watched this yet, get ready, because we're about to drop the bomb. His nurse turns out to be royalty from the original planet that the pirate planet was constructed by, right?
She was not descendant from. She was the original queen.
Yeah. I
mean, she'd been around, you know, they hadn't seen her in hundreds of years, but she was really there, you know, and she was creating like some sort of projection of her own body as this sort of fetching young, but still bitchy woman that she would eventually transport her consciousness into.
Yeah. Yeah. And basically the doctor and I guess one of these, Zanakians, you know,
Xanax.
They basically come across this queen while she's in her chamber, you know, basically almost comatose, you know, and she's aged and she's, you know, withered and she looks like she's on almost her deathbed.
Well, she is. I mean, they basically said that she's, you know, in the last seconds of her life.
Yeah. And she's basically using, quote unquote, time dams.
Yes.
To stop the progress of age,
right.
And what powers the time dams is the destruction of every world that she passes through.
It's not just the destruction of them, but it's also the fact that they take these, you know, used up carcasses of worlds, smush them down into like basketball size, put them in these trophy cases, and the fact that, you know, they would collapse into a black hole because they're so dense, but
yeah.
You know, because of the way that they're aligned, you know, the gravitic forces balance each other out. And the amount of energy that creates is what powers the time dams.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So, I mean, now, was it the world's compressed? Because to me, it seems like, but, you know, see, here's the thing where you go, but wait, there's more. Because on top of that, you've got the captain who is apparently terrified of this queen. You discover later, you know, a lot of his bluster and the way he talks like this is because he's trying to impress the queen and show her that he's competent. At least that was my understanding of it.
Actually, if anything, I thought he was trying to, you know, by being a big blowhard, he was trying to downplay just how smart he was and, you know, sort of be like this, you know, big goofy, you know, doofus, but, you know, still this genius engineer who is plotting behind the queen's back to, you know, create this, you know, wall of energy so that he can enter the time dams without breaching, you know, the universe, basically. Go in there, kill her, and then he'll be free of her.
Well, yeah, see, so what I didn't fully, and what I mean, what I, the way I understood it was that it was the actual deaths of the world that were keeping the time dams, you know, charged, and then it, he was keeping the worlds so that he could eventually, like, implement his plan, which would be to use the energy of those worlds to break through the to destroy the time dams, and then, therefore, like, the last seconds of her life would continue, and she would just die.
That's it, yes.
Okay, so maybe I didn't misunderstand it, because the whole reason that I understood that the worlds were being kept, and that this guy, the captain, was so ended up being so brilliant, was so that he could use that energy to, you know, eventually get destroy the time dams or destroy whatever technology she was using.
I thought it was also that he was, that the balance of them is what also power the time dams, and that they kept mining the planets so that they could actually power the jumps of the ship, you know, so they could keep the ship running. You know, so okay. That they needed resources.
Yeah. Well, either way, he's using, you've got one person using it for one reason, which you don't find out about until the end of the episode. And I just found it kind of really smart that what you end up finding out that, because I mean, I kind of, once the nurse showed up, it was very obvious that, like, okay, she's in charge, you know,
right.
Like that wasn't a surprise to me. Like, they telegraphed that like a mile away. That was like Western Union sending me something from New York. Like, the nurse is really behind it. Now, the way that it all played out, where it was like, I'm the one in charge, but the guy who's really in charge is not in charge, but he's really just trying to bide time so he can kill me. That, I thought, was really smart.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree.
And I really enjoyed that aspect of it.
It was a well-layered story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then you've also got, you know, again, but wait, there's more. That they decide that there's an element that they need to fix their time warp drive thing for the ship, right? And the only place you can find it is
Earth,
right?
Right.
Yeah, Terra,
yes.
They call it. Of course, they call it Terra.
Right.
And then once the doctor discovers this, he's completely horrified.
Right.
And he's like, you can't do that, you know? And they're like, but we will,
right.
You know?
Why not?
Yeah, why not? And so then you actually, you know, come across what happens after that. Like, how does the doctor stop them all from implementing their plan?
Well, he had, you know, he had befriended the Mentiads.
Yes.
And he was having the Mentiads basically storm the Death Star / ship / mountain, you know, the bridge.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had these mental powers that they're able to use telekinesis and stun people and stuff like that. And they were, you know, going in, they were immune to the laser blasts because they use like mental force fields against them.
Yeah.
So they slowly shamble on in, you know, they overwhelm the guards and they get up onto the bridge. Of course, in the meanwhile, the captain has a surprise for them. He has sort of like a psychic interference generator that he's created that dampens their telepathic field. And then all of a sudden now they're just schmoes in yellow robes. So, but you know, the doctor has K-9 set up a counter jamming field. They get their telepathy getting going again.
But not before K-9 dies out like an iPhone.
Right. That's true. Without a Mophie.
Yeah, he basically almost powers down because his batteries have not been charged.
Well, he was very busy fighting the captain's, like, you know, robotic hawk.
Yeah, that's right. His parrot.
Yeah.
That's right. We should mention that the captain has, like, a robotic parrot that he uses to destroy people when he gets pissed off at them.
Right, exactly. I thought it was very touching, though, that he had this guy, his major domo, his second in command, Mr. Fibulae.
Yeah.
He was basically threatening to kill throughout the entire episode. And then when Fibulae ended up dead because of, you know, the action of the Mentiads and blowing stuff up on the bridge, he was very upset. He was like, you know, he called him his friend and I will avenge you. And
yeah, yeah.
It was very sweet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He basically, it was like, you know, Abbott and Costello,
right?
Where it's like Abbott has been smacking him around for like the whole movie, but then, you know, if somebody else messes with him, he's like, don't you fuck with that, you know, right. Costello, you
he's
know,
my is, bitch.
Yeah, he's my bitch. Exactly. So, I mean, yeah. And so by the end, you know, Doctor Who discovers, you know, that the Queen is using some sort of like illusion projector to, you know, transfer her consciousness into, you know, this living, whatever.
Hologram, basically.
Yeah, right. Hologram, so that she can remain young and immortal, you right. know, until the end of time. And the Doctor very, you know, ingeniously points out that, you know, this is not going to last forever. You can't just keep blowing planets up.
Because you're going to need the amount of energy you need to power this thing, you know, is exponentially rising. You know,
yeah,
you're going to have
yeah.
to take on a galaxy next? What?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, I mean, yeah, and then by the end of the episode, they actually manage to transport their planet to, like, Earth's vicinity, but the Doctor, you know, using the method almost that, like, they accidentally used in the beginning of the episode, you know, it's kind of like a callback, you know, he decides to transport the TARDIS to the exact time and place that the planet is going to appear
right.
so that they can't surround the Earth, right?
Right, and that causes, that's actually what causes all the bridge, you know, components to short out. Mr. Fibulae dies, you know, a lot of the, you know, basically the TARDIS got a good smacking around too, but...
That's true.
You know, she's tough. So, you know, that was not even the end though, because at the very end, you know, when the captain is dead, the queen is dead, you know, and then now the people have their freedom, and the Doctor blows up the bridge with my favorite is he uses an old style like dynamite plunger.
Yeah. That's great, like a Looney Tunes cartoon
yes.
or something. Yeah. He pulls it out, but I love his like little. He goes to the Mentiads. He's like, "Am I going to blow this place up, or are you?" And then the Mentiad guy basically uses his mental powers to like lower the plunger.
Right.
Yeah. That was really cute. I mean, I really liked it. What I found really interesting is, well, and then what's the big revelation at the end about the piece of the key to time? Because that's the other thing is, like, during the whole episode, I was like, did we forget about the key? Like, something, did the writers just, like, have we forgotten that we're searching for something here?
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, that whole thing, that whole quest part of it kind of just disappears.
Well, because they didn't know where it was, because when they land, the tracer is going insane. It's just like ticking all over the place, like they can't figure out why. And then, you know, they actually only figure it out towards, not quite at the very end, because like it's when he's in the trophy room that he figures out that the entire planet of Calyphrax is the second key piece to the key to time.
Yeah, which I found to be like a really neat, sort of like a very old school comic book revelation.
That's also a very Douglas Adams thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? I guess so. Yeah. I really liked that. I was like, oh, the whole planet. But then there was a part of me that was like, because did they ever say whether that planet had people on it?
No, I think they implied that it was basically a frozen rock. It did not have people on it. It had a lot of mineral wealth, but it didn't have any inhabitants, because obviously to waste the entire population would not have been cool.
Yeah, exactly. To make the segment of the key to time. And that's the thing that you never see at the end. You never actually see them show like, hey, this is the second piece, you know?
Right.
He just kind of like runs off into the whatever, the woods or something, like waving goodbye or
well
whatever.
He did say that, well, you know, one of the things that, hey, because the Doctor is so incredibly clever, he said that what he was going to do for the people of Zanac, because they were going to be homeless in a minute, what he was going to do is he was going to set the planet to, you know, settle down in a nice part of the galaxy, and he was going to take all of the broken carcasses of the old planets that were in the trophy case, throw them into the center of Zanac, and they would expand, because all of a sudden the gravitic forces that were keeping them compressed wouldn't be there. And they would fill in the hollow part of Zanac. Zanac would be a whole planet again. And they would just be a regular planet from then on. And then, you know, Romana asks him, well, what about Gallifrax? We need that. He says, oh, I'll just sort of knock that out and we'll just pick it up later.
Yeah, exactly. Which,
but, you know, there's no way they could figure out how to show that in 1978. So they're like, oh, we'll do that later. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, we'll pick up that piece, you know, on the down low when right. it's all over. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's sort of the capper that I sort of missed at the end, was them being like, this is the piece. Here we go. I don't know if they're going to do that in the beginning of the next episode, maybe, but, you know, or the next part of The Key to Time. Because I don't know, for some reason there was maybe the completist in me that just wanted to see them like, oh, here's the other piece and let's combine it with the other piece and now we have two. You know what I mean?
Epilogue. You get to see more pieces later on. I don't know if you get to see only the two pieces at one point, but I know at some point you see 3, 4, or 5. So,
oh, that's good.
You know, you definitely see them being assembled.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so so this is part 2 and part 3. See, what I don't understand is on Netflix, it seems like they give every four episodes is a different season. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like the way they list them. Like this is listed as like season 15 or 16.
Or 11 actually, which it's not.
Oh, really?
I think that they don't really understand, you know, how it works. Like, I think they're considering like each story to be.
Yeah.
Maybe it's actually S stands for story on Netflix. I don't know. But it's, because remember, it's sort of like a hodgepodge of all the classic Doctor Who's. It's not.
Yeah.
I mean, they do have them in chronological order, but they don't have all the Tom Bakers, they don't have all the John Pertwees.
No, of course not.
The ones that do have streaming, though, from the older ones, are the same ones that the BBC showed with, you know, the old Doctor specials. So,
oh,
it was interesting that, you know, like the old episode of Sylvester McCoy, Remembrance of the Daleks, that's on Netflix. The old episode they had of Colin Baker, Caves of Androzani, I think it was, that's on Netflix. You know, that old Tomb of the Cybermen that they showed on the BBC special, The Doctors Revisited, that's on Netflix. Same thing with The Green Death, too. And The Aztecs, the first Doctor episode, that's the only one they have on Netflix.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, yeah. I mean, back in the day, I rented a couple of the early ones, like the first Daleks, and
yeah.
I think there was something, The Aztecs or something, yeah. Which is like really wild. I have to say that I really did enjoy this. The thing about, like, even this Doctor Who, and the thing that I like about the modern day Doctor Who is just how much it just reminds me of really like old school comic books, like, again, Jack Kirby, Stan Lee,
yeah.
Just like riffing about crazy nonsensical scientific adventure shit, you know, at a mile a minute, and that's
always,
what I really.
But
what's that?
But with a lot of continuity to their own story.
I mean,
you know, like, you know, you'll always get in the, you know, a Jack Kirby comic book. You'll have, you know, at least in every book, one reference to, you know, 50 books ago.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah, which is how Marvel Comics used to be. Yeah.
You know, the same thing with. Even in this episode, you had when the Doctor was when he woke up from being unconscious and he said, no more Janice Thorns. You know, that's basically what he was telling Leela in a few episodes, you know, a few seasons ago. He said, stop shooting people with poison arrows.
Oh, gotcha.
Janice Thorns, yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
It was.
Yeah, yeah. It all seems like very linked. It all seems like, you know, there's definitely a way things work. And sort of a code to things, and you know, but at the same time, there's really, like, there's definitely a couple of moments where I'm like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, you know, this is some crazy stuff that they're doing on this show.
Yes.
And that's the thing, is that, you know, very much like, the thing is like, I really, when I'm watching these episodes, I really feel like I'm watching, like, this is 78 and Star Trek ended in what, like 66,
yes.
Something like that. 69 or something like that.
69.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm just like, this is like not even Star Trek level effects, people.
No,
but the thing is that they shoot for the fences. They don't care. You know what I mean? To me, it reminds me of like, a YouTube video, a modern YouTube video, where, you know, these people are just like, screw it, we're just going to tell a story. And that's what I really appreciate about it, that they just were like, we're going to tell the craziest, wildest sci-fi stories, and it doesn't matter that we don't have the effects, it doesn't matter that we don't have, like, you know, lightsabers, it doesn't matter, we're just going to tell these stories and we're going to go for it. And they succeeded in making something really great.
They gave the characters, even the tertiary characters, the secondary characters, they gave them a backstory, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of thought going into these. And that's the thing that I noticed, too, in this particular one. There's a lot of, like, dialogue and talking, which you don't necessarily get with a lot of sci-fi. And it's because they have to fill the time. They can't have people shooting with phasers or transporting down onto the planet, or, you know, Doctor Who doesn't get into, you know, karate fights with people, you know.
Well,
he talks things through.
No, well, Pertwee did.
Oh, did he really?
Oh, yeah. He was very happy to use his Venusian Aikido. He's very famous for that.
Tom Baker doesn't. Let's just put it that way. Or at least I haven't seen him do it.
No,
but
never. Never.
That's
he
why
would
I
never
feel
hit
like.
Anybody.
Yeah, I feel like that they make up for their weaknesses in a lot of strong ways. You know, one of them being that they fill the, like you said, the background story of it. They take the time to explain everything and not in an idiotic way. You know
right.
what I'm saying?
Right. Well, and that's one of the good things about having, you know, Romana as a companion, because he's not going to be condescending to her too much. A little bit, of course, but, you know, she's basically his equal. She could fly the TARDIS. She actually knows more about it than he does, even though he's used to it. So, you know, having her as sort of the giving him the ability to explain to the audience what's really going on by talking to someone who's his peer is great. I mean, you hadn't seen that really since in the Pertwee days of this scientist, Liz Shaw, who is a human, but super smart. So, you know.
Oh, gotcha. So what is the next chapter in The Key to Time?
Oh, God.
Do you know off the top of your head?
I don't remember.
Let's see. I've got Wikipedia right here at my fingertips. Let's see. The Stones of Blood.
Yeah, I don't remember what that one was about.
That's going to be the next one that we watch. You don't have to tell me what it's about. I don't want any spoilers, but that's what's going to be coming up next for us to watch. And,
great.
You know, anybody out there who's listening who wants to, you know, follow up and keep track of, like, you know, the old Doctor Who or classic Doctor Who, you know, that we're watching, I think The Stones of Blood is the next one. And I think those are on Netflix as well, correct?
I believe that's correct, yes. I think the one after that is not.
The Androids of Tara?
I think those are not, but they might be available somewhere on the internet that I don't want to repeat in a podcast. But lest the BBC lower the hammer. But
I think they are on, they're also on, let me see, Androids of Tara. They're on DVD, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, the whole box set is on DVD if you want to go spend, you know, $400 on it. But
well, yeah, that's true. But the Androids of Tara, you could buy it on Amazon, or I'm sure you could just rent it off of Netflix if you have the disc plan.
Maybe.
You know, so that'll be the next one. I'm looking forward to that because I'm actually liking these more and more as I go.
I'm glad.
You know what I'm
glad. To me, the fifth one was complete crap. But
the fifth one?
The Power of Krull. I thought
the Power
was garbage,
of Krull.
But the sixth one was really among the best of all of the Doctor Who stories, let never mind Key to Time. I thought the sixth one, The Armageddon Factor, was among my favorite Tom Baker episodes, period.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, and that one looks like it's six episodes long.
It is.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so, I mean, next up will be The Stones of Blood, probably in about a month or so.
Okay.
Maybe even sooner if we get eager and are looking for subject matter.
Sure.
You know, but I got to say, you know, it's really grown on me, and I'm so glad that you've kind of made me or introduced these to me, because the ones that I have seen that I've rented on DVD, like, I think the big Tom Baker one, there was a Dalek one where they retold the origin of the Daleks.
Well, the Genesis of the Daleks, that's considered, like, one of the best ones in all of Doctor Who history.
Yeah, and I actually really liked that. And I think that I rented that one because at the time, you know, I was into the modern Doctor Who and I was like, what are these Daleks? I kind of know a little bit about them. And then I found out that there were a bunch of different origins. And so I just remember the Ark in Space being like, this is kind of boring.
It was
like,
weak.
This is not very good. And then the genesis of the Daleks was excellent. And I remember up until the end where they do some kind of like ring around the Rosie thing against a black mat and they're like falling. Maybe I have to watch it again, but at least these first two segments of The Key to Time, I've really enjoyed and I'm glad that I got the chance to watch them.
Well, I'm happy to have obliged.
Well, thank you so much. Cool. Do you have any other last thoughts on this part of The Key to Time?
No, I think I'm pretty much exhausted on it.
Cool. Well,
I guess the only other thing I would throw in is that, you know, as great as it was, it's still 1978, you know, and there's a lot of just very, like, you know, like when like basically sexist things going on where you have, you know, Canine telling Romana or the Doctor, let Romana make first contact. And he says, why?
Oh, yeah.
And he says, because she's prettier than you.
Well, that is true.
I mean, well, yes, but
I don't know that. I guess my sexist meter needs to be jacked up a notch because I didn't really find that too sexist. I was just like, I just kind of nodded and went, mm-hmm, yeah, he's right.
It's true, but I mean, you don't really expect to hear that from a robot dog.
I guess not. Yeah, and that's the other thing. I'm really amazed as to how much Canine has grown on me.
Oh, I love Canine.
At first thought, I'm like. And I think I saw him in a lot of the, what was the companion? The Sarah?
Sarah Jane Smith.
The Sarah Jane Adventures. I think that was maybe sort of my first exposure to him.
Yeah.
No, it was the episode of Doctor Who where she guest starred before she got the spinoff. And I remember being like, and having heard about K-9 being like, what, really? But he's actually kind of grown on me. And when his battery was dying in this episode, I was like, I'm sad. Is he dying? I was like, anyway. Well, this has been the Part-Time Fanboy podcast episode of The Pirate Planet, which is the second chapter of the Doctor Who Key to Time. My name is Christian Horn. And I've been joined by Baron Negrin, who is our Doctor Who expert. And we hope to join you in about a month or so with the third chapter, The Stones of Blood.
Dun,
sounds
dun,
very
dun.
Eerie. Cool. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
No problem. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy. Part-time fanboy.com.